So, Joe, you got a new pen.
Yes, and I actually have another one that's supposed to show up today.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. This is maybe Joe diving deeper than he intended at the beginning of all this.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
So thanks. I know what thanks pen you have received, but because I sent it to you. Do you want to tell everybody else what you got?
I have a... So Mike sent me a Twisby Diamond 580 AL. It's blue, right?
Prussian blue.
Prussian blue. Yeah, I wasn't sure what the technical title is. I put it back in the box.
You're going to do an unboxing?
I'm totally doing an unboxing for Twitch whenever I get back from vacation.
All right.
So I'm super excited about this. Thank you. I think this will be fun. I still have to come to grips with the potential of putting something other than black in it.
Yeah, you can't put black in that pen.
Yeah, so I have to come to grips with that.
It looks too pretty to have black ink in it.
Thanks. Thanks for that. I have a 580 that I have black in, so it would be fitting to have blue in this one, for sure. But that's one that you gave me. I have a friend of the show now, Nib Grinder, is sending me a Twisby Eco with a custom grind nib on it that's supposed to arrive today. It nice. Actually might show up while we're here on the show. So between the two of them, I'm having a very hard time coming to grips with the fact that I can, like, I want to do the unboxing and stuff on Twitch because I think that would be super fun for all of us to do that together.
It would.
But that means I have to wait until after vacation. And that means I cannot take these pens with me on vacation when I'm expecting to do a lot of writing.
Quite the quandary.
This is a problem. I actually have debated doing like a Saturday afternoon Twitch live stream just so that I could get these pens out and have them with me on vacation. And I pitched this to my wife and she said, no, you're going to be busy all day Sunday. Saturday is our day to get ready for vacation. So here we are. That won't happen. Apologies.
Oh, well. Well, you have some fun stuff to look forward to when you get back.
Yes. Yes. I will have a lot of enjoyable experiences whenever I get back because I have been talking to a few folks and I've learned that a lot of people really enjoy these Twitch streams. So my goal is to do a lot more of them when I get back.
Cool.
So should be fun. Should be fun. And the first one will be unboxing these pens, and I'm going to be setting that up as soon as I can when I get back.
I also have a package from the Nib Grinder, although I am on sabbatical this week, so I'm not home. It has been delivered. Yeah. My mother-in-law is there, so it is not sitting on the front porch, which makes me happy, so no one comes and takes it. But I have not had a chance to open it yet. I am very excited to do so because it has a special grind on it. It's an architect grind when you hold it normal, but it's a hybrid grind. So when you flip it over and use like the back of the nib, it's like an extra fine.
Really?
Which, yeah.
That's interesting.
I never even knew that was a thing. But
yeah.
So yeah, I'm excited to dig into this, and I'm thankful to the Nib Grinder for the services. I can't wait to unbox that, and I'm already looking through my collection and thinking through what other pens can I send them to get grinds done on.
What's the pen itself?
It is a Twisby 580, I believe.
Okay.
I forget exactly which one it was, but
that's a solid pen.
Yeah. No, it was a Twisby 580 because the original Twisby 580 that I had, I then gave to somebody as a gift.
Sure.
So I've been gifting a lot of pens lately, replacing. Much to my wife's, what's the word? She's happy about it. In her words, she told me the other day when she found out that I got the Prussian Blue Twisby 580 for you, she's like, you're using your addiction for good.
Proud of you, Mike.
Thank you.
It sounds like Rachel is too.
Yep. All right, enough about pens.
Yes, we could go on for a long time.
Let's do follow-up. We've got lots of action items from the last episode. You want to go through yours first?
Sure. Yeah, so I have four. The first of which is to attempt meditating once more. And I think that has been working out well. I've been hitting it about 4 or 5 days a week. So I would say that's decent.
Not bad.
You know, I'd say that's at least a step better than it has been. It seems to be helping with my ADD stuff too. So that's, I mean, that fits into the category of things that will help improve ADD is meditation. So my hope is that that is something that continues to be a positive, and I will continue going down that endeavor. At the moment, I hope it doesn't, you know, fizzle out at some point. So that's one. Number two is journaling. I have been less successful with this, and I don't know why, because I was doing like okay with it before reading our last book, Stillness is the Key. And for whatever reason, trying to focus on doing that made it harder. Don't know why.
All right.
There you go. That's what I know on that one. So actually have a bit of a, you know, when we get into today's book, that particular point will come up again. Number three is seeking solitude. I've attempted to try to find times when I could build solitude times into my week so that it's more frequent. And the fourth one is taking walks. I've been very unsuccessful with these two. I think that's because I'm going on vacation, one, and two, this coming Sunday, so in 2 days, we're putting on probably I'm leading and putting on the largest production I have ever been a part of. And it's requiring a ton of time and effort. So I don't know that time this is all said and done. Right now I'm not successful in those two. I know that. But I don't want to take those off quite yet because I know that I've been under some really extreme circumstances in the last week to 2 weeks. So I'm kind of chalking it up to that at the moment.
All right.
That's what I know. So those are my four.
Okay.
Your turn, sir.
I've also got four, and I'll go in order that they are listed here. So the first one was be in the moment, and I think I've done a better job of this. The biggest way I've seen this play out and why I say I can successfully do this is that there have been times in this last sabbatical week where I have felt the urge to pull out my phone and take a picture and immediately put it back and just enjoyed being with my family. So there's positives and negatives to that because we don't have as many pictures. And kind of what I've landed on as my distinction between those two, it's going to kind of stink when I look back and I'm not in a lot of the pictures. But if I'm not part of the moment, like I'm just not going to, I'll go ahead and capture it. But if I'm involved in it, I'm not going to distract from it. With kids specifically, the moment you take out a phone to take a picture, immediately they're all like, I want to see. And the thing is over. So that helped me.
That drives me nuts.
Yeah, that helped me decide the right way to handle those situations because I recognize if I was trying to document it, I would immediately break it by taking out my phone.
Yes.
So if I can do it discreetly and they're just doing something else, like I have a picture from this vacation where Rachel and Adelaide are like painting their fingernails, you know, I'll document that kind of stuff, but I'm not going to worry about we're all at the beach. I got to get a picture here so I can remember this moment. No, just enjoy being there.
Yeah, totally.
The next one is to limit my inputs. And I really haven't had any inputs. I've been disconnected from just about everything. So this is the wrong week, I guess, to try and do this. But I'm not too worried about this as I transition back into the normal work next week. There are certain inboxes I know I need to check. Email, people already know I am either very good at or very bad at, depending on your perspective. And I'm okay with whatever you think of that. So apologies if you expect a quick response and you don't get one, but
whoops,
nothing personal.
Take a back seat. You'll be all right.
Yeah. I do think one of the things we've talked about as we come out of the COVID quarantine period is not wanting to jump back into things and trying to maintain the margin that was created for us when we had to stay at home. And we are thinking about and finding new ways of doing things. Like one of the boys specifically, we found out one of the missionaries we support actually is trying to raise money, and they're very talented musically. So they're doing virtual piano lessons. So we're going to try that instead of going to the local music shop, support the missionaries that we were supporting anyways, but more directly. And I think it's going to be a pretty good fit. I don't think it's the right fit for all of our boys, so we're going to try it with one first.
Sure.
But it just, that's one example to me of like the opportunities and other options are there if you look hard enough for them. It's just we default to like, this is what everybody does. So we got to go to piano lessons. We got to go to basketball and soccer practice and all the other stuff. No.
Right.
No, we can figure out a new way to do things. Let's see. The next one was Bujo for journaling. I've succeeded at this, but not in the way that I thought I would.
Okay.
So when I thought about this and initially had it as an action item, I pictured myself writing freehand. This is what happened today at the end of the day. I didn't do that a single time. But I have started doing that at the beginning of my day with morning pages, except it's not pages plural. It's more like morning page.
Okay.
And I have a whole section devoted in my bullet journal for those morning pages. I started it this week. I've done it a couple of times. I really, really enjoy it. I like that a lot. And I think the end of the day journaling is going to appear a little bit different based on the book that we are reading today. I've got action items in there. So I'll just throw that out there as a teaser. We'll get to that in a little bit. So this is not done, but will continue to evolve, especially after we cover today's book. And then the last one, make a routine out of everything that I can. I did not make a routine out of everything that I can. I can give you one specific win, though, before we left on the sabbatical. I mentioned specifically in the Tiny Habits episode that I have trouble using the inversion table that is in my bedroom, for crying out loud, and getting a meditation practice to stick. So the last 3 days before we left, I did it every single day, both of those things. And the thing that made it work is combining them together. So I fire up the short 5-minute daily headspace. I go on the inversion table. I do the breathing exercises while I'm hanging upside down. And then when the meditation's over,
nice.
It's like my timer. I get
nice.
Back up.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I've been anxiously waiting to share that example because both of those things, I had such a hard time getting them to stick when they were separate. But when I combine them together, it's easy.
Sure. Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I don't know why.
I'm going to hang upside down and breathe.
I don't know why I never thought of that before. It is a little bit weird. And some of, depending on the meditation, I could see it not working because some of them, they're like, now feel the breath from the top of your head going down through your body to the bottom of your feet. And with me, it's backwards. But my experience
starting
with...
your feet, come down to your nose.
Yeah. My experience with Headspace, though, one of the reasons I like it, is that it doesn't really get into that sort of stuff. It's more so just the training your brain and what are you focused on right now. It's not trying to tell you, think about this, then do this. It's more so recognize what you're thinking about. Okay, now let that thing go. Breathe in, breathe out, you know, pretty basic. So it's a pretty good fit for me. So yeah, I would say that is a big win.
Awesome. Well done.
Thank you.
You're in better shape than I am.
Well, I'm coming off sabbatical, so... That helps.
There you go. So you're coming off sabbatical. I'm coming off a double workload. So
yep. So next time it'll probably be flipped. But
sure.
But that brings us to today's book, which is an extension of the whole habits thing that I have been obsessing about lately. Today's book is Triggers by Marshall Goldsmith. This was one that I originally heard about from the Cortex book club that they do semi-annually.
Yep.
They covered Triggers a long time ago and heard Gray and Mike talk about it, and I was intrigued by it. So I bought the book, and it had been sitting on my shelf for a long time. And I just felt like this was the right time to go through this because we had just gone through Tiny Habits, and after reading this, I believe that it was the timing was appropriate. I'm not sure how you feel about that, but I felt like this brought a lot more insight into the whole triggers or the cue aspect of the habits and the routines. And I feel like there's a lot that you can glean from this in terms of triggering those positive habits and setting up your environment for success.
Yes. I feel like this is... I'm just going to jump out here and say I'm torn by this particular book. Okay? Let me just say that. Because it's like we've done enough of these style, like habit, behavioral change types of books that... We're now, like, I feel like I'm starting to compare them, and I like this one, I don't like that one, that one said this, and this one says that, and they're kind of the same, but they're different, and I'm hoping that when we're done today, I know how to fit this one into the others, because at this exact moment, I'm conflicted on what I think about this one.
All right, that's interesting. I can see that. I guess I have a little bit different approach where every time we read one of these habits books, I feel like I understand the topic of habits a little bit better. But I've also been thinking a lot about how I think, if that makes any sense. One of my gap books was going back and rereading How to Take Smart Notes. And this was specifically because I was starting to play with Rome Research and wanted to figure out, is this the right tool for me or not? After reading that book, I am even more sold on the idea that, yes, Rome Research is the right thing for me. And I got a lot more out of the book the second time, to be honest. I think I was a little bit skeptical and cynical the first time I went through it because he was advocating for an application that I looked at before we recorded, and I was like, nah, this is garbage. And I still don't think that application specifically was going to work, but I feel like Rome really can. And I've been challenging myself to... not just put stuff in there in a filing cabinet approach where like, okay, if I want to go back and look at my sermon notes from a specific date, I can find them, but putting them in there in a way where they connect together. And that's challenging. It's not my default way of doing things. And I recognize that as I've put in my book notes from books that I've read is like, okay, so I've got all these notes, which look great in a mind map, but how do I connect these things? And that's not always easy. It kind of changes how you take notes sometimes. And so I feel like the way I've taken notes has kind of changed and evolved lately, and I haven't created the this is everything I know about habits page, but I'm looking forward to doing that.
Sure. I'd be very curious to see like what your writing is around habit and behavioral change, like right now. I'd be curious about that because like I have recently gone on rants about Rome Research and Obsidian and all these tools that are trying to mimic each other right now. Like that is something I've gone on not exactly pleasant rants on.
Yeah.
So like I'm kind of against some of that, but I understand like it has its place. I get how it's helpful to certain people. I'm just not one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing video for the members today, and so I've got these awesome cherry plywood boxes that I made for my note cards that I am using to do a paper version of what Rome Research intends. So that's been an interesting experiment.
And if that works for you, more power to you. Not yes. Going to work for me. And I think that's okay. I've actually in the last week, because one of the rules of sabbatical is you can do whatever you want, but you just can't have obligations. So you can't plan ahead.
Sure.
Which, by the way, means that next time I have to be a little bit smarter about scheduling podcast recordings.
Yeah, we talked about that. Yeah.
But I have this week hopped on a webinar that you hosted, hopped on a live stream that Brad Dowdy was hosting just because I saw it come across and I'm like, oh, that sounds like fun. I'll do that. You know, yeah. I've also walked Bodie Quirk through Rome and David Sparks. I'm also paying for it myself. I dropped down the large 5-year amount. I'm not going to say how much that is, but I am all in.
That's
with
commitment.
It at this point. Exactly. It is. So I feel like I've explored enough. Now it's, I got to invest in it. I got to put stuff into it. That's not the reason I dropped down all the money. I really do think it's a cool application. And the community around it being able to just like come up and build stuff. And then the founders would be like, hey, yeah, that's really cool. Go check out what this person's doing. I don't see that happening with any other application out there, really. Like, if OmniFocus or Evernote or whatever, two very different applications, I get that. But like a proprietary application was like, okay, this is how you use the app. And then the users were like, actually, we're going to use it this way. I don't think they would be like, well, yeah, we'll just change our business model so you can use it that way. But that's kind of what's happening with the Roam community at the moment. So
sure. Yeah.
It's interesting, but I digress. So one of the things that I discovered, though, from walking people through it is that it's not the right tool for everybody. There are certain use cases where it's totally not going to be worth the cost that they are asking specifically. It is not a cheap application. But for the right person, it totally makes sense. I feel like I am the right person given my hybrid bullet journal, not bullet journal system that I'm trying to do. So
the pseudo Bujo.
Pseudo Bujo, I like that. Yeah,
it's totally what I'm gonna start calling yours.
The Sujo.
Sujo. Yeah, I think mine is like borderline by the book.
Yep.
You know, there's some extensions to it, but no, I follow it quite closely, it seems.
Yeah, I wrote this up for the Suite Setup, by the way. I'll put the link in the show notes. I've gotten so much feedback about that specific article. It's probably 10 times the amount of feedback that I've ever gotten on any other article that I have written. And it's all been really positive. So thank you to everybody who's reaching out and encouraging me to keep going with this. And it's cool to hear how other people have kind of morphed their own system. But yeah, so we'll leave that for now. Go back to the topic at hand.
Sure.
So habits and triggers. This book is not specifically about habits. He does reference the original habit loop from The Power of Habit, and he's got his own version of this as well. But like the name implies, this is primarily devoted to the triggers and the environments that can kick things off. And the book itself is broken down into four sections. So part one, why don't we become the person we want to be? Part two is try. Part three is more structure, please. And part four is no regrets. The first two parts are definitely the biggest, but I think for the bookworm format, it makes sense just to tackle these sections and not try to talk about the chapters themselves.
Yeah, I think that's fair. When I was trying to figure out what format this was going to take, I was grateful this was your book to make this decision on, because I was thinking, like, there's a lot you could cover here. They didn't do three parts, which I was grateful for, so they went to four. I don't know if I enjoy three-part books or if I just like making fun of them because it's fun to make fun of it, because they're all three-part books for the most part. So it was especially refreshing to see that it was a little bit different. But yeah, I think you've got a good outline here to start with. But yeah, I think it is interesting too that, you know, he's focused on one specific part of the habit loop. You know, when you take a step back from, you know, the entirety of what you read here, he's really focusing on one specific piece of the broader habit loop, but he's also not focused on habits. He's focused on behavioral change. Like, that's a lot of what the intent is in the book, is this is about changing your behavior. This is about deciding, you know, making decisions to stop doing something or to start doing something or keep doing something that's positive. But he wants you to make you aware of those decisions. I think that's the overarching view that I got from this, is just stop and think. And how do you do that?
Which I find refreshing, to be honest, because I feel like talking about behavioral change separates it from the negative stigma maybe that is typically associated with habits, because habits, by this point, anybody in the productivity space probably feels like, I know this stuff already, I just can't do it. Which there's some truth to that, but I feel like with behavioral change, it kind of feels like a fresh slate and thinking about it a different way. So it's kind of like, oh, I've never tried it this way before. And there's that initial optimism that goes along with that. And then also to help create a sense of, I can trust this guy, He's got lots of lists, lots of diagrams to explain things, although the majority of them are going to happen in the beginning of this book, and some of them I feel like are more powerful than others, but all of them I think are good. They're all kind of based on the same format, which makes it maybe easier to understand what's going on, but also harder to remember a specific one because they all kind of blend together. They all tend to be like these four different quadrants, which that's what productivity books do, is they create graphs like that. So it is what it is. Let's jump in here to the first part, which is, why don't we become the person we want to be? Because our environment is working against us, is the short version.
We're not smart enough.
Yes, exactly. We don't recognize the triggers. We fall prey to the initial responses. But he then kind of talks about how it doesn't have to be that way, which when he said that, I was so glad, because he kind of pointed out in the book the same issue that I had with the power of habit, where you've got the cue, routine, reward, and it's not just automatic. You go from stage one to stage two to stage three. There is an opportunity for you to change things and to take control of the situation. Just because there's this thing in your environment that is trying to trigger you doesn't mean that you have to give into it. So maybe that's the place to start, is what exactly is a trigger? And he defines it as any stimulus that impacts our behavior. It can be direct or indirect. It can be internal or external. It can be conscious or unconscious. It can be anticipated or unexpected. It can be encouraging or discouraging, and it can be productive or counterproductive. That means that the trigger in any of those scenarios can be either positive or negative. And it's maybe a little bit polarizing to classify things as either good or bad. But the bottom line is, there are either behaviors that you want to start that you aren't doing, or behaviors that are you view as negative that you want to stop doing that you're having trouble stopping doing. One of the stories regarding that is Nadim and Simon, where Nadim is like this rising star, but every time he has to interact with Simon, Simon just pushes his buttons and causes this interpersonal conflict. And they're talking about how the conflict, yes, maybe Simon is responsible for it, but there's nothing Nadim can really do about it. So take control of the situation, recognize the triggers are going to be there when you walk into the environment, and what are some of the things that you can do to take control of the situation?
For sure. Yeah, I think this particular section, like going into what are triggers and how does that work out, like that's one that I got bored with quickly. It's a thing that my sense is, like, what is a trigger? We kind of just intuitively know that. I get that he has to explain it and give examples and show us how important they are, how bad we are at working with them, you know, where they come from. I get that he needs to do all that, but in my head I'm thinking, oh, I hope he moves on quickly. So that part I really struggled with. I think it was simply because it felt like we've talked about this a lot. Maybe that's because we've read the other books. Maybe that's where, because of Atomic Habits, The Power of Habit, Tiny Habits, like maybe because of those that made me think that way. But I also don't know how else he should have started. So it's probably the correct move. It's very likely just me.
So just follow-up question then. What was your impression of the inner belief triggers section?
As in, like, my core that triggers things?
In chapter two, he listed, like, 15 different inner belief triggers, and he numbered them, and then he also listed what those things triggered. I'm not sure if you remember that list, but that was one of the things that really stood out to me right at the beginning, was this list. I thought this was pretty impactful. Maybe it's just because I never really thought about these things, maybe like you have, but I don't know. There was tying the thing that it triggers, the negative behavior typically that we want to change. Like, for example, number one is, if I understand, I will do. And the thing that it triggers is confusion. Number two, I have willpower and I won't give in to temptation, and that triggers overconfidence. So as I read through this list, he basically is reading my mail and describing me to a T for all the things that I don't do when I say I want to do them, like meditate and use my inversion table, for example. And as I read this, I was like, well, maybe I didn't have to have that epiphany moment. Maybe I just need to understand myself a little bit better and why I have trouble doing these things.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, the lists and things, I would say they clarify things somewhat. I think for me, especially in recent months, I have been hyper focused on understanding and becoming aware of what it is that causes me to do different things. Like I've had to learn that, because with my ADD getting significantly worse, it's become a thing that I am forced to become aware of. So maybe I've meditated on this concept without being fully aware of that. That's very possible. You know, maybe it's an unconscious thing. Maybe it's a semi-conscious discovery research sort of thing. But I'm not going to say it's bad. There were definitely some things that I think it clarified for me, but not hugely.
Okay. I felt like this was pretty powerful and completely...
I'm not discounting that.
Yeah. Well, like number 10, for example, says, my change will be permanent and I will never have to worry again. It produces a false sense of permanence. And he talks about how the great Western disease is, I'll be happy when... dot, dot, dot. You fill in the blank. He says, fairy tales end with they lived happily ever after, not reality. But that's the exact argument that the entire book of The Antidote is based off of. And he disarms it in two paragraphs. When I read that, I was like, oh, there, Oliver Berkman, you obviously missed that memo.
There is that. Details.
Yeah. So I guess the list to me was more than just a list. It was a condensing of the research and the experience that this guy has, which, again, he's not really blowing his own horn like, hey, listen to me because X, Y, Z. But I don't know. It felt at this point in the book like the right thing to set up the validity and like why you should listen to him for the rest of the book. And again, that maybe wasn't even his intention, but like as he went through that list, I'm like, okay, yep, I can tell because we've read these other books on habits that you are presenting a list of all of the arguments and all of the pitfalls that people are going, like me, are going to fall into. So I want to know how to avoid this stuff. You now have my attention.
Yeah. You have captured my curiosity, and let's go.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that there wasn't any of that for me. I simply struggled to, like, it didn't hook me, I think, the way it hooked you.
Okay. That's fair.
You know, I think sometimes books, you know, in the first chapter or two, sometimes the way that they present the problem is one that can get you so interested in the rest of it. Like Stillness is the Key was that way, where it grabbed you right away and you wanted to, like, here's the problem. And then here's how you, like, the rest of the book is how you solve that problem. Like, that's how a lot of these are set up. And he presents the problem here, and I don't think it grabbed me right away, which I kind of expected it to. And maybe that was it. Maybe I had expectations of it that it didn't.
Sure.
You know, step up to. But I don't think I'm nitpicking. I think I'm just at a spot where I wanted him to get to the content of, like, okay, I get the problem. Let's come on. That was my thing there. So maybe that was just me being impatient.
Could be.
It kind of, well could be.
Kind of leads us to the Wheel of Change. So maybe this is a good spot to talk about this. So
segue. Totally planned that.
The other point we had in here, which we kind of talked about, is the environment. The environment is related to the triggers, basically just recognizing the environment and recognizing what parts of it you can control, what parts of it you can't. And just because you're in an environment like Nadim with Simon, being in a meeting where he knows Simon's going to be there, he knows Simon's going to push his buttons, not being upset that that's unfair, that's happening to him, but what can he do to take control of the situation? And that's a story that actually shows up multiple places throughout the book. But the last chapter in this first section is the Wheel of Change. And this is, again, one of those, like, 2x2 grids kind of put on its axis. It kind of reminds me of like the Michael Hyatt delegation circle. So you have, I can't even use like an X and Y axis because it's this big X, and you've got basically on opposite ends, you've got positive and negative, and then things that you want to change and things that you want to keep. So from that, you can create the four quadrants where they are creating, eliminating, accepting, and preserving. Creating is the positive things that we want to change. And if we're satisfied, we tend to yield to inertia. If we're dissatisfied, we tend to fall for every new idea. That description right there was challenging to me because I feel like I, in the past, have been the person who would fall for the new ideas. Lately, been kind of stuck in the inertia. And when someone says, hey, there's this new thing, you should check it out, I tend to resist that. My default is to resist that. Now, I just said I completely checked my productivity system and I'm using Rome Research. So,
and you jumped on Rome at like a whim of the hat.
Yep. So I get that I'm a little bit of a hypocrite here. But that's one example. And I think when it comes to like the productivity stuff specifically, in the past, I would have been like, oh, there's a new email app. I should try that thing. And there's this new efficient, this thing is going to be more efficient for me. It's going to save me a little bit of time. Therefore, it is better. And I should change. And I've kind of intentionally leaned into like the whole analog stuff. That's the exact opposite of the inertia, in my opinion, when it comes to productivity. Productivity, most people think of as like efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. And I'm kind of intentionally going, no, I want to be less efficient on purpose. So I don't know. That was one, I guess, observation based on like past Mike versus current Mike. Preserving, this is the section where you want to keep positive things. This requires soul searching and talks about, in this section, we really get credit for not messing up a good thing. That really spoke to me. Because I am in the middle of rethinking a lot of different things. There are a lot of things I've decided I'm just going to leave this the way it is. It's good enough for now. There's a whole chapter in this later about being good enough. But I recognize when he said that there's a possibility when you switch something to say, oh, this provided me a benefit in X way. I can do this a little bit faster. When it comes to quality, maybe not so much. And there is a very real risk that when you decide to try something new, that what you had was actually pretty awesome and now it's broken. And now what are you going to do? So I don't know. I don't have any specific examples, I think, of something I've messed up lately. And I'm, oh man, I should have left that alone. Do you have anything that kind of falls into this category?
Technically, yeah. I've messed up a lot of things lately.
I'm not talking about one-off stuff, I guess. It's more like systemic changes. Sure. I'm going to change the way that I go about things because I think it's going to be better, and then discover, nope, actually, that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I've done some experiments with like what time I get up in the morning that have gone poorly. I used to be a 5 a.m. person. In recent months, like the last probably five, I've been more of a 6, 6:15 a.m. person. That has more to do with health stuff than anything. So, which comes with its own challenges. I'm still not 100% on my morning stuff because the kids get up at 7, which means that the amount of time I have in the morning to get things accomplished, like in those quiet morning hours, like my focus and the time I have to get into focus in the morning is gone. So I really only have time to get up, get myself ready, you know, read a few pages, and then I'm on to breakfast and the girls are down helping with breakfast. And that's different. So that's it's very different from me having the chance to spend 30 minutes writing in the morning and making sure I've got 20 minutes to read. And, you know, I don't have time for those in the early morning anymore. So it's forced me to change when I do those things. And in some cases it doesn't happen. That's why I don't write as much as I used to, because I don't have the time, because I'm sleeping during the time that I would normally have been writing. So it's different. I don't know that I would say, you know, per his wheel of change, the four, which he loved those, you know, cross charts.
Like, yeah, he did.
With the four directional arrows, like he loved those, and they all have blended together in my brain now. So I'm not sure which ones, which this one I know because you described it, but like I struggled with that particular piece. But yeah, with the four different sections, as far as like, what should you get rid of? What are you going to keep? That I think is difficult for me to say in respect to that morning routine, because there are things I would want to add. That's a place where I would love to have an additional behavior happen, but I don't think that's realistic because it's going to force me to make some decisions that I don't want to make. I say that, and like this coming Sunday, I'm going to be up and out the door by 4:15. So that'll be a rough one. Definitely gonna come home, take a nap, and then go to bed early that night. So yes, it'll be a busy day for sure. I don't know how I got there. Well, morning routines.
I think this wheel shows the counterbalancing that has to take place with things like your morning routine and getting the writing done. If that's something that's really important to you, that's something you want to create, that's fine. But then you've got to eliminate other things. And that's the third quadrant here, is the eliminating section. This is where you want to make changes and you want to remove the negative things. And this is where you start to drift into territory where maybe it's not all negative. Maybe it's just not quite as positive, and you have to make the hard choice that I'm going to choose this thing because it's better than the other thing. So in a perfect world, you are getting enough sleep and you are writing, but since you have constraints and you can only pick one, you're going to get enough sleep instead. Now, you could feel bad about not getting the writing done, or you could say, nope, I've picked the most important thing, and that is fine. So I think these kind of balance each other out, although he didn't necessarily describe it that way. And then but he does say in this section, not to sacrifice the future on the altar of today, and that the real test is sacrificing something that we enjoy doing. So he does kind of allude to the fact that you are going to have to say no to some things sometimes. And then the last one is accepting. This is when you have something negative and you decide to keep it. He said this is really hard for business people, but it's most valuable when you are powerless to make a choice. So if you cannot change the situation, learning to accept the situation may be the freeing thing that you need to let it go mentally. This one spoke to me because I tend to get frustrated about the way things are and wish that I could change things, and I really can't do anything about it. So I sit there and I brew on it, and I'm like, man, this isn't right. How do I create a different environment? You know, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you just got to roll with the punches. You know, control what you can control and let the rest of it go.
Yep. Sometimes you can't change things, Mike. Sad day.
It's true.
It's worth a shot, though.
Give it a shot. Part two. Try.
Yep. Didn't intend that, but hey, there you go.
Nicely done.
This one, I feel like, is the section that we have a lot of our action items from.
Yep. I completely agree. So in this section, he talks about passive versus active. He's got the four levels of engagement, which again is a 2x2 grid. This one goes straight up and down and left and right instead of being tilted on its axis 45 degrees.
Yeah.
So you've got proactively positive, which is committed. You've got passively positive, which is professional, passively negative, which is cynical, and actively negative, which is hostile. And he mentioned in here, I've heard this statistic before, but in a 2011 Gallup research study, they showed that 71% of workers were disengaged or actively disengaged. So cynical or hostile on this particular diagram with their work. And that just is kind of shocking to me, but not if I sit and think about it. It's sad, I guess, is the best way to put it. The big takeaway from that section, though, is the difference between the active and the passive for me. And he talks about how there are six engaging questions. And passive questions tend to be the ones that don't inspire any sort of change. The six engaging questions that he mentions are, did I do my best to set clear goals today? Did I do my best to make progress toward my goals today? Did I do my best to find meaning today? Did I do my best to be happy today? Did I do my best to build positive relationships today? And did I do my best to be fully engaged today? I like those questions. And the active questions, basically what it's doing is it's asking, did you put forth the effort? Not did you get the thing done? So without directly addressing the issue of goals, I feel like he's on my team and not a big fan of him.
He is on our team in this sense.
He does talk about goals, but in this sense, the successful completion of the task, the movement towards the goal is literally just, did you apply the effort? And that is very different than the prompts that I have as part of my journaling routine. So he has these daily questions that he asks himself. He shows an example of this. He talks about tracking it in a spreadsheet on a scale from like 0 to 10 in terms of his effort. I don't want to go that far, but I do want to rethink my journaling prompts and change those to daily questions. So next time I will report back what my daily questions are.
All right. Sounds good. This is one that I want to do too, but I think I'm going to steal his questions straight up.
All right.
Because I think, I don't know if I'm just using that as a cop-out, but when I read these questions, this is the part of the book that truly resonated with me, but I feel like he keeps coming back to this very regularly throughout the rest of the book. But these daily active questions are ones that are designed to really help you keep yourself in check so that you're not just acting haphazardly or by default. And that is something I think I could resonate with very deeply. I'm not going to talk about how he alters this a little bit later. We'll get to that. But the concept of asking these questions daily, I feel like, is a very good journal prompt.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense. Like, if you take stillness as the key, that concept of journaling and slowing down to settle yourself and become aware of how you acted that day, what went well, what didn't, what do you want to change? That sort of concept, it really resonated with me, and it's why I have it as an action item and will continue working on that. And I'm hoping to do a lot of that actually over the next week while I'm gone, hopefully relaxing. I'm quite certain my phone is going to be in airplane mode almost the entire time. It's going to become a camera devotedly next week. That's my intent. And I think that these particular questions, you know, did I handle myself well today? Did I treat my wife well in that hour that I spent with her? Like, those types of questions, you know, he has his set here. But I feel like those would do really well in the sense of a journal prompt. So that's how I intend to use those. But that would be at the end of the day for me.
I feel like if you use them as journal prompts, you'll be writing for a long time.
That's very possible.
Which will make it harder to stick. But I guess we'll have to report back. This is why I want to modify what he's doing, because I don't think I've done the prompts and making it easy, and all you got to do is select an item from the list and still find myself resisting journaling and breaking it down into the least number of questions possible. And if you look at his spreadsheet, he's got like 20 different questions that he asks. And there's no way I would go through all of those, let alone give myself a score from 0 to 10, a completely arbitrary score, which I've done this sort of thing in the past with like the star rating at the end of my day. But I find myself pushing back against that, because what does a 4-star day really look like? What is a 2-star day? I have no idea. So what's the difference between an 8, a 9, and a 10 when it comes to one of these questions?
Sure.
I want to make it as simple as I can, yes or no, and maybe use those as things to kick off additional journaling, like freeform writing. But if I do that, then it's got to be just a couple of questions. Even 6 is probably too many. So I need to think this through on what exactly this is going to look like. But I do like the idea of the daily questions, checking in on the different areas. The theme system journal, by the way, does something like this, where they've got the different areas and they've got the circles. And the idea is basically you can fill in the circle if you did it, you leave it blank if you didn't, or you can fill it in halfway if you didn't a little bit. Just those 3 different distinctions, not like a 5-point scale or a 10-point scale. I feel like that makes it more attainable. but I also don't want to do it in day one anymore. Gasp. I know. I've been finding myself.
Really?
Yeah. So I use day one for a couple specific things. My journaling prompts, which
I have to I'm in a bit of shock at this moment. Like, to me, you and day one were in the womb together and everything is done together.
Not
like,
too
that's
far
the way
off.
I see you.
Yeah, and full disclosure, my subscription just came up and I did resubscribe for another year.
Okay.
But I know I want to move my journaling to my bullet journal. I also know that I've got a notebook full of quotes inside of day one that I can't connect to anything, and that makes way more sense inside of Rome. Ding.
Yeah, somebody was saying in the chat we need a bell for every time Rome comes
up. Yeah. So there's two different types of things that go in there. They are the things that I want just like a log of that I can go back and review at some point. And day one really isn't all that great for that. That's no different than like if I were to snap a picture of my journaling and put it inside of GoodNotes, that would serve the same purpose. I'm going to go through it once a year, maybe. That's no big deal. And then the other stuff, it was easy to capture those things and put them in there, but then they just sit there. So what good are they doing at that point? I've also got like a stories file where I was developing different stories that was based on some feedback I got from a speech coach, Aaron Beverly, actually, who last year, I believe, won the international Toastmasters competition, the World Championship of Public Speaking. I worked with him not too long ago, and he told me to just start jotting down different stories and breaking it down into different points so that you can go back to those story files. You can grab different pieces of those based on like how much time you have to tell those stories, but have those stories basically at your disposal. So I was collecting those inside of day one for a while, but again, like I can go into day one and get them out of the filing cabinet, but they're really not, that's not the way I want them to work anymore. I want them to be interconnected. And so I've been thinking about what role is there left for day one. It's the templates, but I'm about to remove that. So I don't know. I see a day one-less future for me, which makes me a little bit sad. But
I just am struggling to come to grips with this. It seems like every time we've had conversations that involved journaling, reflection, daily something, day one is always the de facto answer for you.
It is. So, I do think
I'm at a loss, Mike.
I do think there is a possibility that analog journaling just doesn't work for me and I do go back to day one. But I do want to give it a legitimate shot. And if it works, why would I put that stuff in day one? They don't OCR anything. So GoodNotes is already a better place to store a digital archive or backup of that sort of stuff.
Sure.
I don't know. In fact, going back to the that diagram in the article that I wrote about my hybrid bullet journal system. If you notice in that picture, day one isn't in there. And I wrestled with that for quite a while. I'm like, day one should be on there somewhere because I'm using it currently for journaling, but I didn't really see the value of having that as like a separate branch off on its own. So this is not something that I'm arriving at just because I read this particular book. It's something that's been brewing in the back of my mind for at least a couple of months now. Is like, where does this actually fit? Can I justify the $25 a year? More and more, I don't think I can.
I went and hunted down your picture for that because it did not occur to me you don't have day one on there, but you don't.
I don't.
Huh.
And I was very sad about that when I published that article. I'm like, ugh, this doesn't feel right.
Huh.
But I don't see a way that it really works. It's a benefit for capturing, but if that's not the thing that I'm going to use for, it doesn't make sense to have a million different buckets to capture things into. It makes sense to have one or two, analog or digital, so it's bullet journal or drafts, and then ultimately, like, where's all that stuff going to go? Into a big digital bucket where I can connect all of the different pieces, all of the different mental Legos in whatever way, shape, or form I want. That's what I'm trying to build towards. And so having stuff that's not searchable inside of day one because there's pictures and things doesn't really fit.
I
just blew Joe's mind.
Yes, I think this has blown my mind. I'm quite literally speechless here. All right, I'll come to grips with that one, but pen and paper for the win.
Exactly. That's what I wanna say. For now, yeah. And that's really the heart of that article that I wrote, is that things are different now. And the joy I get from pen and paper is really, really important, because I don't know what the world's going to look like in a couple of months. And it's really stressful if I sit and think about it.
No kidding.
So, yeah.
All right. Daily questions, journaling, day one lists.
Yep.
The chat thinks you've been together with day one since day one.
Good one.
Oh, fun times. Can we talk about planning and doing and coaching?
So this is something he actually introduces in the prior section, the planner versus the doer. But in this section, he introduces the role of a coach, which helps the planner become the doer. The planner and the doer, we've probably heard that described before, and basically we're really good at planning, we're really bad at doing, it's like two different people, why can't we follow through on the plan that we set, yada, yada, yada. Well, a coach can help you follow through because they provide a follow-up mechanism, they instill accountability, and they are a source of mediation when the doer is just like, I don't want to do it. Like, you're going to do it. What's interesting to me about this whole role of the coach is that you don't have to have an external person be a coach. Although that's probably the most common way that this works, the accountability, having somebody else to hold your feet to the fire for what you said you were going to do. I think both of us had trouble reading books consistently before we started doing Bookworm, which is one of the biggest wins to come from this. And I think it's inspired other people to try and do the same sort of thing. I don't know that it works for everybody necessarily, but that is one of the things that has worked for us, is the fact that I have to get up every other week and speak into a microphone and sound intelligent about these books that I said I was going to read. So I better read them.
I don't know how many times I've gotten to the point where, like, Tuesday before we record, so in this case, like 3-4 days ago, and I'm like halfway through the book or so. Okay, wait. We're going to do 30, 40 pages a day. We're going to get this done. And I get through books that way. Otherwise, like, I've seen some friends that get curious about reading more and going through more books, but they don't have a deadline. Like, they don't have a thing that keeps them on pace. So
they don't have a goal.
They don't have a goal. And they end up sitting and waiting 2-3 months to finish one book, even though, like, to finish it in 2 weeks, really, it's only about 15-20 minutes a day. And you read a book in 2 weeks. Like, it's not, you know, if you take today's book, Triggers, if you're going through and looking at behavioral change, it's difficult to just say, I'm going to do that every day. Habits don't work that way. And I think that's a lot of what you can get from today's book, in that becoming aware of your environment, becoming aware of the planning and doing, and how the coach can help you go from planner to doer, trying to actually get to the point where action becomes realistic. Like, that, I think, is the key here. And in this case, you know, you have to do some things like set the book at your spot at the table so that you see it when you come down for breakfast. Like, you have to do some things like that to make it more of a successful, like, give yourself more of a chance to pull it off. I think that's important.
Well, on,
and that's a lot of what I think he's getting at here.
On that topic specifically, the previous chapter, he talks about the daily questions in action, and he says that they highlight the difference between self-discipline and self-control. He kind of makes the point that people are typically good at one of these. And self-discipline is achieving desirable behavior. Self-control is avoiding undesirable behavior. I am definitely more towards the self-discipline side. Which one would you use to describe yourself?
I am not self-discipline.
So self-control, the avoiding the undesirable behavior. You can avoid the negative outcomes, but you have trouble starting something new?
It's a mix. That's the problem.
It is a mix, but he said that people typically have a strength in one of these. So I thought it'd be interesting to just talk about which one you think is your strength.
Yeah. I can start new things on a whim very quickly, but in a lot of cases, it has, like, the whole self-control, self-discipline thing, like, I have to build an entire environment around me in order to make that happen.
Sure.
Otherwise, it could be YouTube and goofing around with OBS all day long. Like, and that's not productive.
So you kind of know how to hack the self-control, but it's not the one you default towards.
Correct.
Okay, cool. I thought that was fascinating when he described those two sections and the counterbalance between them. I'm like, oh, I never really thought of it that way, but that makes so much sense. And also recognizing which one of those you tend towards, that can impact what goals he would use, like what sort of targets you're setting for yourself and what sort of accountability you need to build in with the coach. So if you do find yourself struggling with self-control instead of self-discipline, then you need to really make yourself feel that pain of that undesirable behavior.
Yeah.
So I think this is where something like you schedule the embarrassing tweet to go out at a certain time so that you feel compelled to wake up and turn it off before it publishes, that sort of thing could be helpful. But
or in my case, I start an entire site that has scheduled webinars that force me into a deadline, which works well for me.
There you go.
So it works.
There's also a chapter in this section about the last one, AIWATT, which is short for Am I Willing at This Time? The whole phrase is, am I willing at this time to make the investment required to make a positive difference on this particular topic? But I like this. I feel like this is a mechanism you could use to pick your battles. So he tells a parable in this section about this guy, a farmer, who was rowing his boat up a stream and sees another boat coming towards him. He's yelling at the guy, you idiot, you're going to hit me. And then ends up hitting him and he's all upset. He jumps out of his boat. He's going to go yell at the guy, realizes that the other boat doesn't have a driver. So the moral here is that the other boat is always empty. I don't know about you, but for me, that was insightful because I tend to, there's a couple, as I read through this, interpersonal situations where conflict tends to arise, and I find myself defaulting to, well, why don't they just do things this way? And then recognizing that they're never going to do things that way. It's up to me to not get bent out of shape about it. Actually helped me out a lot as I was thinking through those things.
Yeah. I have a tendency to remember the phrase, I can't change what they do, I can only change the way I react to it.
Yep.
Like that's what I have a tendency to recall. That helps me get through a lot of things. The empty boat thing reminded me of the story of the two ships that wanted one to move and they both wanted each other to deviate so that they didn't have to change course. And they're back and forth arguing with each other. I think one of them was like a U.S. warship of some sort. And finally, towards the end of this banter back and forth, they said, we're the U.S. Army or we're the U.S. Navy. You need to deviate. And
like, name dropping, yeah.
Yeah, we're a lighthouse. So
so you should change your course.
You're welcome to keep coming. Like, that's what that reminded me of.
Yeah. Yeah, he mentions in here, kind of to your point, it's pointless for you to get mad at someone for being who they are. That really jumped out at me when I read that. And he also said that the average American spends 15 hours per month complaining about their supervisors. This was interesting because I don't think this just applies to work supervisors. I think this applies in just about any arena. And I don't want to fall into that category. I don't think I fall into that category. But it just shows the prevalence of that attitude and recognizing that I'm going to have the opportunity to do what everybody else is doing and to pile on basically. And I don't want to do that. I want to avoid that altogether.
Which is a very fair thing to do because it's not simple to make the decision to react to something that's offensive with a calm demeanor. Like that's difficult to do. That's essentially what you have to do in a lot of scenarios. Thus, our book last time, Stillness is the Key.
Exactly.
Remember that, Mike.
All right. Next part, part three, more structure, please. As soon as I read that title, I'm like, yes.
I'm on board.
That tends to be me. Can we just talk about what the plan is going to be? No, because we don't know. Oh, all right. Well, so this section, there are a couple things I wanted to talk about. Side note, I guess, at the very beginning in chapter 14, he talks about Alan Mulally and his weekly meetings with the Ford executives. This, I actually saw Alan Mulally speak at the Entree Leadership Summit when I was in San Antonio. And this guy, he's impressive. So this is the guy who was the CEO of Boeing, and then Ford brought him in because they were losing 20-some billion dollars in a year, and he was going to turn the company around. And every story that we've read about him in Bookworm Books has been tied back to this like weekly meeting where people attribute like the green, yellow, red to how they're doing and how their department is doing. And then if it's not a green, talking about what other people can do to help them change it. When he got up and he spoke at Entree Leadership, he had a single slide with like 12 different points on it. And at the very beginning, he's like, this is everything that I know about business. And then he just proceeded to talk through the different points and share stories about how he had implemented this. And just seems like a really down-to-earth, very humble guy, even though he is very, very successful. So it was cool to see him brought up in the story at the beginning. But the big thing that I want to talk about in this section is ego depletion, which is not a new topic. This has come up in different books that we've covered based on research by, was it Roy Baumeister in the 90s?
Yes.
Okay, that we argued that we possess a limited amount of ego strength, which is depleted throughout the day, and that it's not just related to self-control, but it also affects decision-making. So there is decision fatigue that plays into this. A couple of things he said in this book that kind of jumped out to me. Unlike physical exhaustion, we're usually not aware of ego depletion. We can't measure it, but we can document what is or isn't depleting and take preventative measures. So I have an action item to list my depleting events. I've done this already with people. If you remember back to the
I was
plus,
on that
plus
list, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I think that doing the same sort of thing with events can be helpful, because in this book he's talking about, if you know you're going to go into something that's going to be ego depleting, there maybe is nothing you can do about it. You're walking into a meeting and you know it's going to be ego depleting. That's fine. Just recognize that that's ego depleting and don't try to do a whole bunch of those ego depleting things in one day. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself in that situation where that's all I can take and I can't take no more. You know, I've been there frequently. So I want to recognize the contributing factors, and I feel like making that list will help me with that.
Yeah, I didn't go down that route with this. I think it is interesting to consider what it is that depletes you, what it is that, you know, recharges you. I think for me, I don't always notice that I'm depleted until it's way too late.
Yep.
Like that's
me too.
That's kind of the concern, that maybe that's more common, but trying to determine what it is that depletes me versus what can I cut? There's a lot of things I have just in my daily and weekly routines. Like that might be depleting, but I cannot cut that at all. You know, the on a weekly basis right now, running live streams and a whole massive, it's basically a full-blown concert every week the way it's being run. It's tiring and exhausting to do that. It's fun to set up and prepare for that and, you know, and put it together, but it is exhausting. I couldn't cut that.
Right.
You know, that's not a thing I could eliminate. But I think maybe what we're getting at is there are also like some minor small things that happen throughout the week that, you know, specific interactions you run into because you go to coffee at a certain place, so there's a certain person there every time. Like, well, maybe just change the time you go and you don't have to deal with that. You know, I think maybe that's a little more of what maybe you're getting at. But I can't say that maybe I should do this. I don't really want to do this. I'm kind of talking myself around in a circle at the moment. Oh, Mike.
Well, I think you're half right in that is kind of what I'm talking about. But also, I do think that the big things he mentions, that structure is how we overcome depletion. So you can recognize that right now you've got to set up these crazy live streams and there's nothing you can do about it and it's just going to deplete you. But maybe you can make a checklist and maybe you can teach somebody else and offload little pieces of it. You know, that would be just one example of how you could potentially make it less depleting. That's what I want to consider. Because on page 187, he says, if we provide ourselves with enough structure, we don't need discipline. The structure provides it for us. So part of it is eliminating the things that are depleting that I can control. But also part of it is thinking through the things that are depleting and how can I make them less so? How can I implement some structure? Even if I'm not the one who is setting up the meeting or calling all the shots, there are things that I can do before then to go into that meeting more prepared. Yeah, maybe the other person should have been the one thinking of this thing, but they're not going to do that. And I can't change them, as we already talked about. So I can at least think about it and I can make the meeting go smoother instead of freaking out about it before the meeting because, oh, they should probably be doing this and they're probably not doing it. And then getting there and like, I knew they weren't going to do this. Well, what does that help? It just makes it harder from that point forward. So that's kind of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. You know, there are ways I could probably apply that to, you know, bringing other people on board and such with the live streams and such. Maybe I should do this.
Well, maybe you just don't have any awful meetings, because that's the next thing on this list. But he describes the awful meeting. And the exercise here is to imagine that you're about to go into a pointless meeting and that you're going to be asked at the end. You're going to be presented with four questions. Did I do my best to be happy? Did I do my best to find meaning? Did I do my best to build positive relationships? And did I do my best to be fully engaged? I don't know about you, but I can think of meetings that fall into this category where when I read those questions, I'm like, dang it, no. I can't say that. And if I would approach them that way, does that change the dynamics of the meeting? Absolutely, it does.
Yep.
So number one, I don't need to get as frustrated about certain things that are outside of my control. But number two, maybe just me. And again, I'm not the one who is leading the meeting per se. I'm not the one who is dictating where the discussion is going to go. That's, by the way, one of the things I think that frustrates me the most is that I think I am pretty good at that. And so when I have to relinquish control of the meeting, whether or not it is business related and just go with the flow, I can see how inefficiently things are run sometimes. And I get frustrated because I see the inefficiency. But these questions basically challenge me to respond appropriately because it really doesn't matter how inefficient the meeting is. If I do my best in these particular areas, again, passive versus active, then it's a better meeting for everybody involved. And at the very least, I don't leave it with the same feeling that I would have had previously where I would have been upset by what had transpired. Again, I'm not directly contributing to the outcome, but I feel like there is a direct correlation between my attitude and how the meeting goes a lot of times, because I'm an active participant, whether I'm calling the shots or not. But in the past, my tendency maybe is like, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm just an attendee. You know, I feel like I'm selling myself short there and I can do a better job of bringing some positivity.
I have one meeting each week. I didn't used to think of it as an awful meeting, but lately in the last two or three weeks, it has most certainly become one. And I think it's because there is a lot of difficult stuff going on in the world.
Sure.
I think that's a lot of it. And it has led our one meeting in a week to catch everybody up and like, what's going on? And, you know, what are you doing? What decisions are you making? What are you struggling with? Like, those are good questions to ask and decisions that need to be made, but it's messy when you have one department that is trying to ask those questions and decide on those things live in the meeting, and you have another department that will oftentimes make a lot of those decisions ahead of time and just ask for a comment on what they've already decided. So what used to be about an hour and a half long meeting is currently about a 3-hour meeting for me. And I don't have time for this. So I locked out on the last one because it's like, I cannot do this. So I appreciate his questions. I think in my particular case, I'm more prone to want to leave said meeting as opposed to be quizzed about it when it's all done. But I get his point. Like, if I'm going to be there, I need to try to, you know, find ways to build up the relationships with the folks I'm with. Can I be someone who's fully engaged in that as opposed to just waiting for a specific group to finish with what they're doing?
Exactly. And ultimately, the relationship aspect of it alone, if you view the meeting as mechanical and we need to arrive at some decisions and then you leave, and that's the approach you take every single time, you're going to find those meetings becoming more difficult and more difficult, my personal belief. Based off of these questions, it kind of got me thinking that the inverse is also probably true. And so if I go into the meeting with that third one specifically of how can I build positive relationships with the other people that are in this meeting, that makes the next meeting easier and the next meeting easier and the next meeting easier. That's the theory anyway. So it may be 100% true that you just have too much to do today and I need to leave this meeting right now. People are going to offend it if I walk out, but that's too bad because the live stream's got to go out tomorrow morning by a certain time and I got stuff to do. But I personally found myself justifying that sort of action and I'm not really happy about it. So I want to change that for me. And this is probably one of those aspirational goals that I will fail at multiple times before I finally get it. But I do see the value here in that I don't want to be the person who's hard to work with. I want to be the Nadim, not the Simon.
Yeah, I get it. I just don't want meetings to last 3 hours.
Yep, I get that too.
I think I need to start there at the moment. How do I get this shortened?
Sure. We've been going for a while. Should we jump to the next section? The last one, yeah. Part four?
I'm game.
All right. So there really isn't a whole lot to talk about in this section. There's two chapters. Part four is no regrets. The thing that jumps out to me from this is the question that they share in chapter 21. What is the most memorable behavioral change you've made in your adult life? And they phrase this question as something to ask yourself in the future. So like, assuming that you have this behavioral change that you want to affect and you do so successfully, what is the type of thing that you are able to look back and say, I'm really glad I did that particular thing? And this is a different way of thinking about the topic of habits, and I think it's really powerful. Beginning with the end in mind, I guess, is how Stephen Covey would put it. But there's something about that think forward to the end of your life. And what's the most important thing you want to have accomplished? I don't know. Most people don't think about things that way. I don't find myself thinking about things that way very often. I tend to think about, well, this is what I got to get done today. And then I'll think about what's next. But when it comes to behavioral change, I see a lot of value in this, because if you can jump ahead and look at the value of the journaling habit that you've created or the writing habit that you've created or whatever other habit you either personal or professional that you want to establish, you can kind of amplify and magnify the result of that habit. Whereas in the day-to-day, it's, I'm too tired to practice my Spanish today. I don't feel like writing in my journal today. But if you view it as like, I've got these journals, which I can present to my kids. By the way, that actually came from a conversation with Matt Ragland. That's one of the reasons that he started journaling, is he wanted to have these notebooks that he could pass down to his kids. It's a cool idea. You know, grandma and grandpa are gone, but we have these journals of what they were thinking when they were going through the COVID-19 thing. I think that's kind of cool. And so I think this is a valuable question to consider.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is a question that, well, let me back up. There's a story that he tells at one point of a specific CEO, and I'm going to completely blank on the company or the CEO's name, but he had a conversation with the CEO, and this person was planning to retire in 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
And he was having a conversation with him, and he simply asked, like, you know, when you retire, what you going to do? He's like, I don't know. I haven't thought about it yet. Okay. And Marshall asks him, like, well, if your company knew that it was going to have a completely different lifestyle and a different product and a different endeavor that it was going to take on in 6 months, do you think you'd plan for it? Well, yeah, absolutely. Like, what's more important, your work or your overall life? Okay, well, that that puts things in perspective. And at least
he's really good at doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that, like, I don't think that way. I don't know how many times I've heard people talk about how, you know, in Christian circles, we talk about how, like, men are the leaders of their household. And I'm not trying to stereo or, you know, be sexist or anything. It's just kind of the way those conversations go. And that usually means, like, okay, you do these things at work to plan for the future and decide what you're going to do in 6 months, 6 years, 20 years. How many times do you do that for your life or your family? Almost nobody ever raises their hands if they've been asked if they do that or not, myself included.
That is the whole heart behind the Intentional Family Podcast.
I know. So you guys do a good job with that. This question of what's the most memorable behavioral change, you know, it's a great question, and it's one that forces me to stop and think through what's my lifestyle look like, and do I need to consider it from a design stance? A while back, I read a book called Lifestyle Design. I don't see it above me at the moment. I think it's Lifestyle Design, something along those lines. Our friend of the show, Josh, recommended it to me at one point. This concept of thinking ahead and designing what your lifestyle should look like it's a fascinating concept, and it's one that I haven't spent much time with. I don't know that I'm going to sit down and make this very intentional, but I know that I've got multiple hours in a vehicle coming up here in a few days with my wife, and this is some of the stuff I want to talk through with her. It's just like, what does our lifestyle look like, and what would you change about it? And then let's take some of the learnings, you know, that we've talked about here on Bookworm with tiny habits, atomic habits, triggers, all these things. Let's take some of that and figure out how to actually implement those and start working towards them. So if I have an action item off of that, that would be it. Simply some conversations, and then to figure out what comes after that.
Nice. If you want an audio book along the same sort of lines that Rachel and I went through, check out Life and Air by Steve Cook and I forget the other person. And I say audiobook because it's a parable and it's a little far-fetched sometimes, and the audiobook will just keep you going so you don't stop.
Sure.
But by the end of it, it's pretty good, and it really just challenges the way that most people think about designing their life, where I want to achieve this much in terms of overall net worth so that then I can retire. And we've talked about this at different points, how Rachel and I have kind of gone through that. And the main idea it challenges me with is, like, how do you live aspects of that now? That's where the phrase, and I've shared this on the podcast before, we want to be able to make people feel like $1 million, even if we don't have $1 million. You know, we don't have to achieve a certain level of savings in order to start doing small things like that, like paying for people when we go out to eat, if we ever go out to eat again, you know, coffee, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Little things, but it just changes your approach. And it, in terms of interpersonal relationships, number one, it will make the other people feel a lot better, but it does something inside of you too, when you know that like, this is us living out our values and it's not like we're trying to get to a certain point, cross a finish line, then we can start doing the things we want to do, but we're able to do aspects of that now. Maybe we can't do everything that we want to do right now. That's okay. There's like different aspects of that that we can, if we find some creative ways to live that out. So I'm anxious to hear what sort of insight you get when you get back.
I'm terrified. We'll see how that works. I feel like major life decisions happen when this sort of conversation comes up. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, in the last chapter, he talks about how change is good. So don't be scared of the
change. Oh, I thrive on change. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, let's change absolutely everything. Okay,
done.
Gone. Like, I've made the decision. I am on board 100%. Oh, yeah, I suppose there's a lot of ramifications to that decision now.
Yep. All right, that's all I got to say about this book. Anything else?
Likewise. No, I'm good.
All right, action items?
Go for it.
Okay, I've got three. The first one is the Nadim and Simon exercise. I can think of one relationship specifically where I want to work through this. I know that every time I get in a certain situation, I get frustrated and I don't lash out. I don't do something that I feel afterwards like, oh, I can't believe that I did that, but I do get annoyed and I don't like getting annoyed. So I want to think through that situation and think about the triggers. And kind of what he talks about in that situation in the book is you go 80% of the way and you'll see that they'll come the final 20. And that's kind of the approach that I want to take. I want to identify the triggers, the things that typically set me off, and then come preconditioned with some alternate responses when those things happen, because they will. The next one, I mentioned I want to create my own active daily questions. And I don't know exactly what these are going to be, but I will report back what I land on next time. And then the last one, pretend I'm going to be tested at the end of every meeting specifically, pretty much every single meeting I'm in, it kind of drives me nuts. So I want to ask myself those four questions at the end of those meetings and hopefully have a little better attitude and build relationships through those meetings, no matter whether they happen at work, church, wherever. I want to have more positive outcomes from those meetings based on my approach to them.
Those are all very valid action items.
Thank you.
I like it, Mike.
So do you have any?
I will join you. I'm going to join you on this daily questions thing, but I think I'm going to try them as journal prompts. I think that's kind of the way that I think it'll work for me. Maybe that means I'm writing too long, but frankly, I kind of want that together with the action items and journal notes and stuff, like the note capture stuff I have in my bullet journal. I think that would be helpful to me to have that all in one place. Think of it as Mike's old day one, but in paper form. There you go. But that's one major thing I want to work towards. And then I'm going to have this conversation with my wife from, what behavioral changes do I feel like I need to make? Like overarching lifestyle changes. I feel like those are the two places that I need to start. That's my thoughts.
All right.
So, style and rating, Mike. The hard stuff.
This is hard. I really enjoyed this book. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I felt like there was tons of new stuff in here. I did not feel like it was a rehashing of everything that we had already learned about when it came to habits. I feel like the stories that he shares based on his personal experience as a corporate coach kind of lend itself more towards a business application, but it's very easy to transfer this stuff over to your personal life as well. I feel like the models that he uses are very helpful. If there's one negative thing I could say about all the different charts and things that he has, it would be that they tend to look the same because they are all kind of built off of these four quadrants. So it's easy to mix those up. But I feel like there's a ton of stuff in here, and if all you got was like active versus passive questions, and you started asking yourself these daily questions, that could alone revolutionize a lot of things for you. That could completely change your life. I'm not saying that the daily questions will automatically change your life, but there's a lot of stuff in here that I feel like if you were to apply this is very, very, very powerful and impactful. So I am going to rate this at 4.5 stars. I did not think it was going to be a 4.5-star book, honestly, when I started it. But I am very happy to have read this. I feel like it is a very approachable read. You don't have to be a business person in order to get a lot out of it. He's a very good storyteller. He's a very good writer, honestly. I noticed a lot of like variety in his sentences and things. And I don't know. I just thought it was a very entertaining and an easy read. I think I read the whole thing in 2 or 3 days. But
oh, nice.
I've also read a lot of books while on sabbatical. So
there's that.
Yeah.
Nice.
But I think this is a good book. I would definitely recommend this to people. I don't think, I can't think of anybody, any reason why I would hesitate to recommend this to someone. I think the revelation on recognizing that there are triggers in your environment and understanding the things that can kick off those default reactions is pretty powerful. Even if you don't do anything with that, just recognizing like, oh, I'm going to walk into this situation and it's going to be difficult. So you kind of have your guard up. You know, I feel like that alone would be beneficial.
Yeah. I think for me, like I don't want to say he failed. He struggled to hook me at the beginning. So that part was something I had to overcome in this. As far as, you know, how the style of the book is put together, he does use a lot of graphs and such at the beginning that felt the same to me, and I struggled to differentiate. I don't know if that's just because he has a set style of graph that he just loves using, or if there's actually, like, he just hasn't taken the time to figure out a better way to do it, or if that's really just what he continues to come back to. It seems like he really wants to use the Eisenhower matrix for things, but wants to put a twist on it. I don't know. So I did struggle with those two particular pieces. I agree with you. He's a good writer as far as like a sentence structure and how do you, you know, put paragraphs together and how do you tell stories? Like, he's good in that sense. I just think he waited a little bit too long to get into some of the storytelling at the very beginning. He started to do a lot more storytelling in the middle section of the book. So once you get to that point, I feel like it's a little bit better in that sense. I feel like I'm downplaying the book, but at the same time, it's like there's a lot of great stuff here. Like, this is super helpful in the sense that it enlightens you on what does your environment have to do with things. You know, even if there's someone else in the room, they still have a big impact on you, whether you realize it or not. So that's something that just being aware of that and having that as a mental note, if you will, like, that's helpful. I like seeing that. I don't think I would go all the way to 4.5. I think I'll put it at a 4.0 mic. And I think that's just purely because there was some stuff I had to struggle to get over. You know, it's, you know, if you told me that you wanted to read this, I'd tell you absolutely. If you told me you wanted to read a book that helped you, you know, do some behavioral change, I would probably throw you Atomic Habits before I would this one. That one I continue to go back to whenever I'm trying to think through changes like that. I think this one definitely informs that, but I would point someone elsewhere. But that's me. Everybody's got their own opinions, right?
Yep.
I like it, though. It's a good one.
Cool. So what's next?
Next time is Reclaiming Conversation by Sherry Turkle. I'm looking forward to this one. It's a little bit longer, Mike. Apologies. I didn't realize it was as long as it is. Did you already read it? You're looking at
me. I did
me
not.
Like that. But, okay.
I think it's waiting for me at home.
Yeah, it's a interesting. It's about, you know, discourse in the world of digital stuff.
Sure.
Which I feel like that's a recurring theme I come back to. Yours is behavioral change. Mine is interacting with the real world in respects to the digital world. Those are the categories we tend to hit.
It's true.
This one's going to maybe go down the same path. We'll see.
All right.
What's after that?
After that is a book that I originally picked to be a gap book, but I really want to drag you through this.
Okay.
And that is The Crossroads of Should and Must, Find and Follow Your Passion by Ellie Luna. This is a book that I saw Sean Blanc mention in the newsletter that went out, and I've heard him reference this book previously. Looks like it's got a cool artistic style. This one is also waiting for me at home. But I sure feel like this is appropriate given your spirit quest you're about to embark on.
Ah, spirit quest. Nice. I don't know that I'd go that far.
So the even in the title, like the find and follow your passion, I have issues with like that advice, follow your passion. So this might be a rant worthy book. I don't know. But yeah, I think this will be an interesting read, and I think it's kind of a timely thing, not just for you, but as everybody's coming out of this like COVID-19 quarantine thing. I mentioned my wife and I have been thinking about this a lot. What are the things that are essential? And maybe it's not everything that we used to do. So hopefully this book will shine some light on what are the right things to say yes to.
Sure. Cool. I'm game. So you mentioned you've been reading a lot. Gap books?
I don't think I have any here that I did not mention. I finished How to Take Smart Notes. I also am reading at the moment the No-Fail Communication by Michael Hyatt. So I'm going to finish that one for next time. And I don't have anything else specifically queued up, but I will report back. I'm sure I will find something.
Sure.
Unless I get your book and it's like 500 pages, and then I'll just read that one.
It's not super short. I think it's 350, somewhere around there.
Okay.
350, I think, is where it lands. I'd have to go check. I just know when I got it, it was thick.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't have any gap books this time. That's to be expected. I barely got through this one. As in, I had to sit down 20 minutes before we started recording and finish the last few pages of it. So
you got it
that's
done.
That's the way this week has gone for Joe. That's the way it works.
All right. Well, if you want to support the show, you can do so by tapping the button in Overcast if you're listening to podcasts there. That'll take you to the membership page. Otherwise, you can go to bookworm.fm/membership. And you can sign up to become a premium club member for $5 a month. You will have our undying gratitude. We really do appreciate the people who are willing to support us financially. You'll also get access to the live now video versions of the recordings and the MindNode files for all of the books that we read. I upload the notes that I take to the club, as well as a bookworm wallpaper that I created, which Joe really likes. I think it's okay, but
I'm a fan.
So there are a couple perks that you can get. We really do appreciate everybody who is willing to support us. It really does mean a lot to us. These live recordings are always a lot of fun with an audience there. It's great doing them via video. Now we can see each other, and really do appreciate people willing to support us. And if you want to join, you can do so at bookworm.fm/membership.
Yeah, and I was having a bit of a chat conversation with the members who are listening live about us doing the video part public instead of behind the paywall. And it seems like that might be okay. If you have thoughts on that, let us know. Pick up Reclaiming Conversations by Sherry Turkle, and we'll go through it next time.